Hello, and welcome to the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. We bring Bitcoin news, hot topics of conversation, and deep dives into a variety of Bitcoin topics to you weekly. We are Coinbits, a Bitcoin financial services company. Check us out at coinbits.app. This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yeah, how are you? What time is it for you over where you are right now?
I'm in Spain and the time is 8 p.m.
Nice, nice.
Are you more of a nighthawk or a person?
He used to be a nighthawk, but I'm definitely a morning person now. And yeah, basically, since I had the kids, I've been a morning person. So I usually fall asleep at the same time as my wife and kids, but wake up like 3 hours before them.
Get access to those quiet hours. Oh, those are crucial.
The best time in the best time there is, you know, when you know that you will not get interrupted, you can focus.
Oh yeah, there's nothing like it. I don't know if those hours can even be achieved at night, really. I don't know, maybe you're too tired or something, but there's just something about those early morning hours that just the productivity seems to soar.
Yeah, I am more productive before lunch. We have lunch at 5 p.m. So I'm on a fasting thing now. So, and it works pretty well. I can stay productive longer.
Right. I love it. Gaming the system. If I'm more productive before lunch, I might as well just have it at dinner time. That's good.
All right. So are we expecting more people, I guess? But yeah.
Yeah, we can get it going. I actually have a question to start now. We did our research and we've been listening to you for a while, and I don't want to mispronounce off the jump because I've seen a bunch of interviews with you and I've seen people pronounce your name in various different ways. And I would like, you know, at least on the Coinbit spaces to finally just set it. Everybody knows going forward, we'll hear from the source. What is the perfect pronunciation?
Well, it's not cunt. That's for sure.
I'll check that one off the list.
Yeah, and it's not either. So no nuts or cunt. Maybe I'm scaring people who just dropped in away here. But yeah, the correct pronunciation would be Knut Swanholm.
Okay, let's get that one more time.
Knut Swanholm.
Okay. Okay. David, you got that?
Yeah, close enough.
I'll try.
We have it recorded, yeah. So the world is going to know from now on. We finally got our answer. It's awesome.
Don't be too hard on yourselves. Even I find it hard to pronounce, you know.
That's great.
Yeah. So just before we get going, I just want to run through a little intro real quick. It's that we are Coinbits. We are a Bitcoin only financial services company. We help people benefit from Bitcoin by building products that welcome them to the Bitcoin era. And this Twitter Spaces podcast, what have you, is for informational purposes only. This is not financial advice. And we are joined today by Swanholm. And we're really looking forward to this conversation. And Joe, if you just want to take it away.
Yeah, sure. So Knut, great to have you. We've been looking forward to this for the entire week now. To start off, you know, I know a little bit about your background, but maybe you could tell everybody what I'm most interested in, I guess, is, you know, when you were brought to Bitcoin, and I've heard you mention kind of you couldn't look away, so to speak. And, you know, you just kind of went further and further down the rabbit hole and then eventually said, like, I'm going to make this my life's work. What I'd like to find out is what is the main, I saw a killer app, so to speak, about Bitcoin that really drew you to it. Obviously, it solves a multitude of problems in the economy, in the world. But what was the kind of the main draw for you, the main solution, the main fix of Bitcoin that really made you kind of look at it and not be able to look away?
Well, the answer to what the killer app of Bitcoin is, my current answer to that, and I think it'll be my for all times, is that the killer app is you, because Bitcoin changes you much more than you can change it. So each and every one of us are Bitcoin's killer app. The social layer zero is even more important than layer one, the time chain, or layer two, the Lightning Network. So, but for me, like my personal journey, it just made sense. I figured out after 46 years that I'm only slightly autistic. I'm allergic to inconsistencies and taking stuff at face value. All of the things that I was taught about how the world worked didn't really make sense. Mathematics made sense. Physics made sense. The social sciences didn't. And it wasn't until I discovered Bitcoin and started questioning how money works. And later on, I discovered praxeology and, you know, really deep dove into that. And I'm writing a book about it currently. It wasn't until I stumbled upon all that, that the world started to make sense and human society started to make sense of why things are, why people do the things they do, why bureaucrats do what they do, why politicians do what they do, and why people in general try their best, but also often fall for the trap of thinking that stealing is justified and do bad things to one another. So yeah, Bitcoin made total sense in that context, and altcoins never did. Pretty early on, I realized that this was a one-time thing, and it, if the experiment worked, it couldn't be replicated. So even the first article I ever wrote about Bitcoin was about that, and the first mover advantage and how that cannot be copied. You can copy every part about Bitcoin, but you cannot copy the sum of its parts, and you cannot copy the network, and that's the crucial thing. That's why layer zero is more important, and that's why you are Bitcoin's killer app. Bitcoin needs you as much as you need it. So there's that, I guess. I come from a background in shipping, so I've been a marine sea captain for a long time. That's not entirely true. I never got up to the actual, to get my actual captain's license to helm all kinds of vessels. But I used to work on a tall ship for a while and then on some smaller boats. I have my degree and I started working in HR at a shipping company in an office in Gothenburg around 10 years ago and did a little career there and ended up as an HR manager before I quit my fiat life completely when my writings about Bitcoin started to take off so much that I felt I could live off of that instead of mining fiat. So now I do Bitcoin stuff. And yeah, the first year in non-fiat life was pretty surreal and my best career year ever by far. I befriended a president, a couple of billionaires and a prince. So I'm happy. The value of my social network has gone up, definitely. And it's all about that. It's all about your connections and it's about you and me. I mean, I say these terms as if these people were any different to you and I, but they really aren't. We're in Bitcoin. We're all equals. We're all, the playing field is leveled and we're all have a fair game to play now. And that's what's so appealing about it to me. I hope that's a good enough answer.
That's an awesome answer. Could you ever imagine your day-to-day being like it is today? I mean, coming as a former Marine captain and compared to what, you know, describing your experiences, whether it's writing about Bitcoin or meeting with princes and billionaires. And I'm sure your day-to-day, your every day is probably different for you, but that's got to be somewhat surreal.
Yeah, occasionally it's surreal. Most of it is just me living a pretty normal life. I mean, I'm not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just a normal pleb writing books about Bitcoin and trying to make a living off of that. So it's not that I'm, you know, how do you measure success? I don't know, but I've certainly ended up in more surreal situations than I used to. And I used to end up in pretty surreal situations every now and then before Bitcoin too. So, there's Bitcoin has showed me that there's really no limit. What you can do in life if you set your mind to it and if you're lucky. And I guess I'm lucky. What was the question again? I always forget the question because I ramble on.
No, I feel like that's something in Bitcoin where, and we've talked about this internally as a team, it's easy to ramble. And, you know, I don't say that with ramble necessarily being negative. Just because Bitcoin touches different things that, I don't know, one thought leads to another. I find myself rambling all the time. I try to stop myself because I'm probably, I don't know if as many people want to listen to me as they want to listen to someone like you. Easy to ramble in Bitcoin. So no, that was a great answer. David, I'll let you take it. I'll take the next one.
Can I add something?
Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
There was a bit of a method to the madness. I mean, in the beginning, like 2016, and even before that, like 14, 15, when I watched Andreas Antonopoulos videos, like many of my generation of Bitcoiners did, I found the guy himself, you know, and his career fascinating. Here's a guy talking about a new technology that no one knows about and no one fully understands. And he's traveling around the world and manages to live off just talking about this thing. So I envisioned myself doing that at some point. Of course, that was a dream at the time, but now I'm there. This is what I do for a living now. I travel the world and talk about Bitcoin. And I would never in a million years have imagined that plan would actually work, that I could get to that spot. But yeah, my message to absolutely everyone is believe in yourself. You're more valuable than you think you are, and your value your time on this earth. You don't get a second chance. So do it while you can.
Wow. That was beautiful. Thank you. Congratulations on kind of what you've achieved. That really, that kind of creates me how important it is for all of us really to kind of set a good example, because you never know who's out there kind of like watching you and kind of looking up to you and wanting to maybe make a career off of something that looks like, you know, similar to what you're doing. I guess I did have one question for you based on, you said when you were, you know, getting early into Bitcoin, you kind of realized that the altcoins weren't going to cut it and that it's really only Bitcoin. And that reminded me of a Medium piece you wrote on this like alien coin idea from a few years ago. I was wondering if you could rehash that for us, because I think it's a really good steel man argument that you kind of dismantle in that article. It might be good for us to kind of revisit that just continuously to really steel man, like why Bitcoin is the only, you know, the only one, I guess.
This is funny because I don't remember what points I emphasized on in that article, that specific article. Because I remember there was a debate about like, it's a fun scenario to think of. What if there's an alien race comes to Earth and they have a chain with more proof of work attached to it? Do we switch to that coin or do we stick to our Bitcoin? And I mean, the short answer is, well, we'll let the market decide and see what happens. My best bet is that there will not be an alien invasion. And if there is one, they certainly won't use a blockchain, and it will not be comparable to Bitcoin. And like the whole scenario is so far-fetched that it's almost too abstract. And this is coming from a guy who loves abstract scenarios and to think about abstract concepts, but really weird one. But I guess my best answer would be, I don't know the arguments in the article specifically, but I would say let the free market decide what's the better coin to the scenario we actually live in. We live on planet Earth, and there's Bitcoin and there are shit coins that can be categorized into two subcategories: the cryptocurrencies and the kleptocurrencies, also known as the altcoins and the fiat currencies. And thing Bitcoin did that nothing else has ever done is figuring out a way to play by the same rules as everyone else to ensure that we get something on the internet that is impossible to copy or to replicate. So resistance to replicability is the key invention. And replicating that is a fool's errand. If you fall for that, you are stupid and gullible, and you shouldn't fall for that, because of course you can't copy that. I mean, I might sound a little bit harsh here, but the analogy I use nowadays is the game of chess. If you know the rules of chess, you can play chess with every other chess player in the world, and you get the network effect, and you get a huge community of people with whom you can play a game that you all enjoy and get something out of. Bitcoin is exactly the same. If you know the rules, you get the network and you get all the other people that get the rules, and you get to play with them. You can choose to play chess without pawns, and then you can play with a couple of players, but the network effect is just not there. Maybe there's a community for chess without pawns, but it's definitely smaller, orders of magnitude smaller than the regular chess community. And even if there was a, you know, international chess committee of some kind that decided to change the rules somehow, they couldn't just do that without consensus, without the approval of the players of the game. And this is how Bitcoin works. It's just like the game of chess, but it's not the game of chess. It's the game of everything, because it's money. It can be used as money. We can use it to trade goods and services with one another, which makes it the ultimate game and the best rule set at the same time. So yeah, that's an answer to something, I hope.
If it sure is. And I want to just ask you a question kind of based on that and kind of based on your experience. I understand you live in Spain now, is that correct?
Yeah, I come from Sweden, but I live in Spain and I've traveled a lot in my days.
Yeah. Yeah. And from your experience, you know, growing up in Sweden and now living in Spain and all the travel, like, do you see, you know, the, I guess the different cultures, the different perspectives on Bitcoin adoption? Are certain places more closed? You see any kind of patterns there as far as, like, say, Sweden versus Spain or versus another place? And is one culture maybe more quick to whether it's adopted or be open to it or than another?
Yeah, and but for different reasons. I mean, Sweden has a problem with authority. We trust authorities way too much. Swedes in general trust authorities. They trust the politicians. They trust everyone, trust government. They trust the science and so on and so forth. They even trust activist teenagers. So that's, I think, why Swedes have such a hard time gawking Bitcoin, because it goes against their beliefs on so many levels. And I think Stockholm in particular has a bit of a Silicon Valley complex. They want to move fast and break things, and they want to be a flashy startup and whatnot, which produces a lot of shitcoiners and few real Bitcoiners. The real Bitcoiners in Sweden are on the countryside, and they drive combine harvesters and have shotguns. So as they should. Here in Spain, the community is relatively small. And I think it's not because of trusting government, maybe, even though COVID showed that these people have too much trust in government as well, because everyone was really obedient here, which was sort of depressing, because I thought Spaniards were more of a middle of the government type culture, but apparently not. But I think the reason Bitcoin isn't, you know, bigger than it is here is more because people are conservative and they stick to what they know. There's a beauty in that. I mean, there are butchers everywhere and it's nice, you know, and they've been doing what they do for generations and so on and so forth. So I think it's more of a cultural thing here. There are a lot of Bitcoin ATMs, but I think most of them are owned by people outside of Spain. There are, I mean, the area I live in is pretty touristy. I wouldn't say that there's a Bitcoin community, but I'm doing my part, small baby steps here in the little community of Swedes around here. And I think these conversations they're taking place everyone's, you know, in every workplace, in every office. There's a crazy Bitcoiner in a corner somewhere. And whenever there's a bull market, people listen to him and then they laugh at him when some crypto guru goes down and whether there's an FTX crash or there are ICOs crashing or a fork wars or whatever. They laugh at him because they read mainstream media outlets and people get confused. But over time, I think people will have to start noticing that the Bitcoin maxi in the room was right all along. What they need to learn about Bitcoin's price is that they should look at the yearly lows and not the peaks. Bitcoin rises in value enormously from time to time for short periods of time. But the interesting thing about the price is the yearly lows, which are simply increasing. So, yeah. So I think different regions in Europe have different opinions about Bitcoin for difference. Germany is fertile ground for it. And so is the Czech Republic and Switzerland. I think people are very, you know, engineer minded there, or for lack of a better word. They're keen to learn and know things. So that's a good ground for it. But yeah, in the era of the internet, I mean, national borders play a smaller and smaller role in how people are. I mean, we all speak the same language and we're all on the same web. So, and, you know, clever people never really cared too much about passports earlier either. So Bitcoiners will pop up everywhere eventually.
Knut, you spoke about that kind of appeal to authority or fear of authority. In your estimation, growing up in Sweden and seeing all that you've seen, what is that? Like, where does that source from? So I think a lot of us, no matter where we're from or where we live, have kind of had that same question, probably at least a lot of Bitcoiners, probably in the last 3 years. Why are maybe a lot of us Bitcoiners or people who think like us and have the similar values, why are we so different than some others who are so ready to believe X, Y, and Z? And I've heard you mention that about Sweden a few times. It's been mentioned elsewhere as well. And I'm just wondering, do you have any, I guess, thoughts on the source of that? Any hypothesis on why that is? Just curious.
I have some theories. I mean, Sweden, as opposed to Norway, for instance, has been built around agriculture and collaborative industries for many years, hundreds of years. So there's always been like a collectivist spirit, and Sweden has not been involved in any war for like 300 years or something. So they never, no Swede alive today has ever seen, you know, society go to shit, really. So they haven't experienced tough times. Can be tough in Sweden. Don't get me wrong, but we haven't had a, you know, system lapse. So I think much because of that, it's in the culture to not be, to not seek conflict, but to seek resolution and to, you know, agree with one another. So, I mean, agreeing on something is, to a Swede, is often more important than what they agree, the actual idea behind the agreement. And we've had a social democratic government for 70 years, and that has, you know, reinforced that a lot. There's not a lot of adversarial thinking going on. I know there was a British author whose name escapes me at the moment, but he wrote that Swedes change their minds from time to time, but they all do it at the same time, like a school of fish, which perfectly describes what I experienced. And I think Bitcoiners, there are many types of Bitcoiners, and I somewhat buy the theory of the bell curve, that the, you know, the stupidest people and the cleverest people are ANCAP libertarian, and the think they know it alls are all in the middle of that bell curve, and they're dangerous. And they have the collectivist ideas. So it's either get the hell out of my property, redneck shotgun type, or really clever, you know, anonymous globetrotter type person. There might be some truth to that. I think we're more prone to taking risks than other. The true for the earlier you were into Bitcoin. I think there's also a correlation between agreeableness and how early you were into Bitcoin. So the first generation of Bitcoiners were extremely disagreeable, whereas the further down the generations of Bitcoiners you go, the more agreeable people become. So the community is probably a lot more, a lot nicer today in that sense than it was 10 years ago. And there's your occasional oddball. I mean, there are many prominent Bitcoiners that have the line between genius and lunatic is thin, and you can balance those two worlds. I mean, yeah, those are some of the theories I have, I guess.
Yeah, I think the main point there, you know, really resonates with me is kind of this, I guess, this lack of fear of things falling apart. And I think people, it's hard for people to believe that it's all built on nothing, right? Or the money that they work for is printed out of nothing. And I think that's a hard reality check for a lot of people that, you know, maybe that's a scary thing. I think everyone probably can agree on that, how fragile it all really is, this system built on debt and the word of politicians and central bankers, so to speak. And I think maybe a lot of people have an apprehension of coming to that understanding, not because it's not true, but because they don't want it to be true.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, despite all the government interventionism and despite all the bullshit, the free market and the, you know, borders being opened up during the last 50 years and technological advancements has made the planet a very much better place to live. I mean, we have at our disposal, like a guy in a developing country who earns a dollar a day has more tools in his phone than your average king had 100 years ago. So general quality of life has increased, and it is due to the free market. What people don't realize is that this process could have been way, way better. People who improve over time are generally content with their lives improving, but they don't see, what they don't see is how much faster the pace of improvement could have been. So if you compare a screwdriver from 100 years ago to a, you know, a robotic arm applying screws to in the Tesla Gigafactory today, that new machine is orders of magnitude better than a screwdriver. And every technology surrounding the simple screw is orders of magnitude better, which should mean that the prices of everything should have been orders of magnitude cheaper. I mean, every tool and technology that mankind ever invented, we invented in order to save time. And if there's a functioning free market on benefits from the time saving, and yet we work longer hours and we have to take out huge mortgages to finance our homes that our parents built. And it's all because of this fiat scam. But it's because materially, our lives are improving. It's easier for us to get stuff and food than ever before. So that's the real trick. And that's why they've been able to pull the scheme off. You know, that's why they've been able to fool us for such a long time and stealing all of our money. It's because people don't know how much better the world could have been if we had gotten rid of the central banks in the States a long time ago and taken money out of the hands of humans.
You know, I always say that we can't even comprehend what life would be like on a hard money standard. And, you know, I really truly believe that. Like, I can't comprehend it. I don't know if anybody can, because of exactly what you're saying, this constant siphoning of productivity that's just, you know, year over year, it's more and more. I think the federal government just passed a $1.7 trillion spending bill for the next year. You know, people forget in the U.S., the bailout of the banks in 2008 was something like $800 billion. So every single year, exponentially siphoning more and more productivity from people. And those gains don't go to the people. Obviously, they go to, you know, those at the top with well-connected, the politicians, the central bankers, you know, et cetera. And just, you know, to your point, I don't think we wouldn't even recognize a world on a hard money standard. And that's what's so optimistic about all this. And so I just wanted to say, I had dinner with a friend last night that I haven't seen in a while. He grew up pretty wealthy and, you know, he is a young child now. He's with his wife and he was telling me, you know, the world's different today. You know, I can't afford what my father could afford. Like, people don't realize that the world is different. And he didn't really understand why. He just realized that, you know, when it came to trying to put on a christening for his young child, he couldn't put on the same christening that his parents put on for him and had, you know, the entire side of both families, because the cost of today would be literally $15,000. You know, obviously you measure houses and what his parents could afford versus what he can afford today. And all of us, right? We're all in the same boat. And, you know, if you bought a house for $150,000 25 years ago, that house could be easily worth over $1 million today. And, you know, I just found it interesting that he knew that everything's true. He didn't know why. And I think that's probably where Bitcoiners come in.
Yeah, I'm going to go off on a rant here, I think, because I spend a lot of time thinking about what a post-hyper-Bitcoinization world may look like. And while everything you said was true, real, like I said, the killer app of Bitcoin is how it changes you. And the key insight there is that your material cravings will disappear because you have something that is worth more over time than stuff. And that changes your mind. My grandfather had a saying in talks and on many pods before, but he had a saying, that which you can do without, which stuck in my brain. You know, I never met my grandfather, but my father told me about this quote because he really liked it. And I really like it too, because it's like a good insight for every person to come to. If you can do without something, you own that something because you're in control of that urge. So if you don't crave Lambos, you own all the Lambos because you don't need them. So you own that part of your brain that would otherwise have been taken up by the urge to buy Lambos, if you know what I mean. And this is the funny thing. I mean, Bitcoin is a bridge to the other side, as Jeff Booth puts it. But what's on the other side of that bridge? What I see is a world in which we don't need money as much as we do now. The necessity for transactions will go down and not up. This microtransaction thing is, the network is, people will, instead of spending money, it's nice to put tons of cheap Chinese plastic stuff, Christmas presents in such abundance that the kids will have to take 2 days in order to open. That whole bullshit era will disappear and people will become more stoic and more aware and thus less consumerist. Because the weirdness of the fiat monetary is that it makes us think we're rich because we have a lot of stuff. But being rich is about owning your time. That's all. Money is time. And if money was functioning, it would be time. It's a perfect representation of time, of the scarcity of a human life, because it's scarce in the same way as your life is. You will die one day, and then everything disappears. And Bitcoin is scarce in exactly the same way. So it's a perfect representation. So Bitcoin actually is time. It's time in many other senses as well, and you can do all sorts of funny brain farts around it. But this is the key thing. Being rich is not about stuff. It's about deciding over your own time and your own life, what to do every day. You get to decide, no one else. And the more you get into Bitcoin, the more self-sovereign you become, the easier it becomes for you to do that. So that's my, you know, that's what's blowing my mind at the moment more than anything else. Everything else in Bitcoin is mind-blowing as well. But this underlying philosophical truth that was there all along, you know, as the Beatles said, all you need is love. They just hadn't found the equation for it yet. But Bitcoin is love. It is that equation that enables us to love one another instead of cheating, backstabbing, deceiving, stealing, coercing. Bitcoin makes all of that less profitable. And thus it makes voluntary collaborations and love more profitable. So that's the key takeaway.
Thank you. That was very mind blowing, and maybe not mind blowing, but just like, it felt like for me listening to you saying that, it felt like you were just rearranging puzzle pieces for me, but kind of basically touched on a lot of the concepts that you talk about in a Bitcoin magazine article you wrote called The Real Scaling Solution for Bitcoin, which I think kind of touches on this concept of like, when we're in a Bitcoin world, we'll have, you know, less day-to-day transactions. And I was wondering if you could talk about how, because the example that you use for this, and I think it's a powerful one, is the Bitcoin community as an example of like how this might look. And I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that for us.
Yeah, this was sort of much of what I just said was in that article. In hindsight, that article might have been misinterpreted by some because I leave out a lot of stuff like economic calculation, for which money is very important and so on and so forth. So it's not that I believe in some, you know, Venus project bullshit future that won't ever happen. People will still have problems and some will have more material cravings than others and so on and so forth. But the thing about Bitcoiners is that right now, what's that? I think that's Alan Farrington quote, that it's not that how the answer to the question, how come that Bitcoiners know so much about so much stuff? It's the other way around. It's people who know much about a lot of stuff that become Bitcoiners. So you already, at this point, you have interesting people in Bitcoin, and many of them are very friendly and very altruistic, and they want to make positive changes in the world. And they sort of have the tools to do it. So fantastic people all around. And the thing about Bitcoiners, when we interact with one another, I mean, I've never had as many collaborations with people as I do now in the Bitcoin circles. And we collaborate with, I mean, it's all sorts of Telegram groups and projects. There's a cyber opera. There's a, you know, I have 10 people in the group just to help me make my next book. I have a course coming up. I have all these conferences and stuff and all sorts of stuff and movies that I make with Yoni Appleberg and, you know, Guy Swan reading everything. All of this stuff, none of us ever changed a single Satoshi with one another almost. Did this to help one another, just provided the other person with value for value. Obviously, when you start doing that, it's like, helping other people is good. And in the background of our head, in the back of our minds, we run the Bitcoin code. So we all have Bitcoin. So we all want Bitseed. And Bitcoin succeeds if Bitcoiners succeed. And Bitcoiners succeed if Bitcoin succeeds. So we're all incentivized to help this thing come into fruition. So we're all incentivized to help one another. So we do. And we don't charge for anything, really. The funny thing about that is the more you think about it is the better it gets, because this incentive, there's no reason for that incentive to just disappear in a post-hyper-Bitcoinization world. Why would we stop doing that? If we figured out a way to give each other stuff and give each other attention and our time and effort. If we figured out how to do that in this altruistic way, why would we stop doing that just because the family grows and there are more Bitcoiners? It doesn't happen. So you have that effect, and combine that with, you know, everyone's lowered time preference and people's Bitcoin stacks being their most valuable possession. So they choose to give up everything else before they give up their Bitcoin. So they put their reputation at stake. They give away time and labor and love, for lack of a better word. So yeah, the key insight that this doesn't disappear over time, but it's the other way around. It reinforces and grows stronger. The longer I'm in Bitcoin, the more collaborative the community becomes, the more projects there are, the better the projects are. And everyone is honest, and we produce a lot more in shorter time because we function better. There are all these starfish organizations where no one is on a hourly wage or anything like that, or a monthly wage. But if we're making some sort of money off of something, we share it and we stream sats. So, I mean, everything is just better with Bitcoin. And I think it's a reinforcing thing, and that the positive effects of this grow exponentially over time too. So post-hyper-Bitcoinization world is impossible to imagine because it's so much better. It's a world where everything is abundant and almost free because of the efficiency of the market, but we won't have cravings any longer for bullshit. So just really good stuff, cheap, whenever you want, wherever you want, and friendly people everywhere who are keen to help you. Beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you said honesty, because I think that trust, building trust and just trust growing exponentially in society as well is such a key part of that. And kind of
that point, that's so funny, because like the ethos of Bitcoin is don't trust, verify. And ironically enough, what that leads is a much, much more trustworthy community. So that's one of the ironies in this, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I think, Joe, we actually wrote in the newsletter, the Coinbits newsletter a few weeks ago, trust in money builds trust everywhere else, basically. And then I think that's just critical. I would be remiss without asking you, Knud, because your everything divided by 21 million concept was really what brought your work to me initially. And I think it's very powerful. And we were talking about kind of how Bitcoin changes, you know, daily transactions and kind of changes how we operate as people in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. But I was wondering if you could just talk about the 21 million concept. Maybe how you kind of came across that, if your thinking has changed on it since you initially wrote about it, and kind of how you see that going forward.
Yeah, it was never meant as an absolute truth. It's just a hint at the trajectory. I mean, no, it's not only because of fiat going to Bitcoin is going to infinity. So it's not only in dollar terms, but in purchasing power terms. I mean, there's the potential of humankind's potential with functioning money, nearly limitless. And it's beautiful. As long as we have something that is divisible enough and scarce enough and teleportable, we can collaborate like never before. And resources don't have to be misallocated as they are now. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to hint at with that concept. And it's from an article I wrote, and I was very sleepy when I wrote the article, so I almost fell asleep. And I thought maybe I should read through this again before I send it. But then I said to myself, fuck it, I'll send it anyway. And I sent it to Hodlnaut and Citadel 21 magazine, and didn't think much about it until I heard Guy Swan read it out loud while walking home from a steak dinner with Bitcoiners in Copenhagen. Or walk into my hotel. And I remember hearing it the first time, which was like a couple of months after I wrote it. So I almost forgot about it. But it struck me like, this is probably the best piece I've written so far. I was really happy about it. And then we made this little animation where the equation showed up. And you have Guy's voice saying, imagine everything there is and everything that ever will be divided by 21 million or whatever the sentence is. And it just took off and completely changed my life. And now I have a folder on my computer with everything divided by 21 million tattoos that people have done all over the world. And it's just a weird thing to experience for sure. And in the beginning, I was a bit ashamed of the equation because like, oh shit, I'm going to be remembered for an equation that makes absolutely no mathematical sense whatsoever. Then I thought about it a bit more and like most of the famous equations didn't make any sense when people came up with them to the community at the time. Schrodinger's equations, for instance, made very little sense to his peers. So yeah, I'm pretty happy about it now. Why wouldn't I be? It's awesome. I'm feeling very lucky that stumbled upon that because I think it was out there in the ether somewhere and I was lucky enough to stumble across it.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect, just the perfect way. I've really found it useful to use it as a way, not even really to pitch Bitcoin or educate people about Bitcoin, but really to show people how deflationary money is a good thing. And, you know, you show them that video and then they see Bitcoin being used as an example and then it kind of clicks. So it's just a really powerful idea.
Yeah, we have a new video coming out hopefully next week based on that idea with the All You Need Is Love and the Beatles hadn't found the equation for it ideas and Bitcoin, about Bitcoin, the idea and the meme and all the things I talked about here. So it's coming soon, don't it?
Hey, Knut, I got one of your everything divided by 21 million hats on, but I want to know, when are you going to start selling your classic Knut Svanholm hat that you're always wearing? That's what I want to wear.
Oh, you mean that? That's
the one that you have glued to your hat?
Oh, yeah, the sort of Mexican-looking hat. That's a funny story about that. That was during my sailing years. I was ashore, you know, pub hopping in Mexico, and when I came back to the boat, there was a hat hanging outside my cabin. So someone must have wanted me to have that hat. And still to this day, I don't know who bought it for me, but it was a gift for me, obviously. It's a hanging on my door. You should have this hat. And I've been wearing it ever since. And that's like more than 10 years ago now. And it's pretty scruffy at the moment. It's very hard at this point, that hat. But I wore it in Riga. That's the first time I brought it to a Bitcoin conference. So I still have it and it still works.
Some replicas. So, yeah. You got to make some replicas, man. I want to have a bunch of people walking around like new.
It wouldn't be the same though. That's my hat and that's my, you know, that's the hat I'm throwing into the ring for best hat in Bitcoin thing. I mean, Jimmy Song is giving me a run for my money, of course, but maybe I'm giving him a run for his. I don't know, but something about Bitcoiners and hat. I've got mine.
Fair enough.
If I ever run out of money, I might auction out that hat on Fleb Market or Scarce.City or something.
It's a good new revenue stream. At least a good one to fall back on. So, Knut,
as a one-time revenue stream.
So as we kind of get to the end of the hour here, we don't want to keep you too long. We know it's a little late on your end. But I do want to ask you, what are you most excited about for Bitcoin coming into the new year and as we go forward? And also, like, where do you see adoption going? What do you think it's going to take for more adoption, for mass adoption, for quote unquote normies to get it? Just kind of your overall outlook.
Insanely bullish as usual. Things may take time, but the thought is comforting that you have your Bitcoiner weirdo in every office in the world. Like, and it doesn't go away. And as long as it doesn't go away and just keeps on doing its thing. And that in combination with the upcoming SAT squeeze, I mean, I think people are underestimating how weird things can get with the price of Bitcoin and the purchasing power of Bitcoin. Because right now, the world is in a state of fear. There's fear of Putin and fear of the climate and fear of all sort of, you know, scary clowns. So people are reluctant to try new things when they're in a state of fear. But then they're reluctant to buy Bitcoin because Bitcoin has had such a huge rise over the last decade. So people are waiting to see what the market does. And in the meanwhile, the clock is ticking and there's less than 2 years left to the next halving, right? I hope I'm right on that. And during 2021, the Federal Reserve printed $21 million per Bitcoin mined during that year. So in a not so distant future, $21 million per Bitcoin is a bearish price projection or price prediction. So I think it's just a matter of time before there's a snowball effect of, you know, proportions that we've never seen before. Once the final bull run starts, it's going to get really fucking weird. But When I say weird, I say that in a good sense, because I think a faster adoption is better than a slow one, just considering what Bitcoin does to people and what it enables and how harmful fiat really is. So I don't see the worry that it's going to be violent if it's too fast. What people who say that miss is that it's violent now. You're under constant threat from your government, and you need to pay that mafia a fee every month. And in addition to that, you need to pay every time you do a transaction. So you're under gun threat now. So you're living in a violent world right now. And the faster Bitcoin adoption goes, the faster we get away from that. So I'm only positive. This force for good is so positive on every level. So, you know, trying to like spread FUD about it, or it's a fool's errand. I mean, the higher the price of Bitcoin, the better Bitcoin becomes, because then the developers become better funded and can worry about Bitcoin instead of worrying about their own financial situation. And the same goes for everyone in Bitcoin. So I think and people don't understand the consensus rules. They don't understand the implications of having a system which, you know, forces but only changes if everyone agrees that it should change. What that really means is that it can only change for the better. Bitcoin cannot change for the worse. It can only be better, because everyone has to agree before a change is implemented. So it either stays the same, which is completely awesome, or it gets better. So, and if you think that a little longer, that means that humanity can only get better from this point on. So I'm very optimistic about everything. Knowledge about Bitcoin and Praxeon has given a very cynical mind a huge injection of hope and optimism. I think learning about this stuff and trying to comprehend what it really does and what freedom means and how powerful a free market is, it's a remedy for cynicism, and you become appreciative of your fellow human beings like never before. You realize that every, you know, cashier at the supermarket is doing her part for the greater good of humankind by just participating in the economy. And when you realize how insanely powerful all of that is, that we have Bitcoin now and nothing can stop it, and it can only get better. It's just, I'm uber bullish on everything. And the scaremongers can go fuck themselves, because I'm not scared. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you avoided an error that a lot of people make, in that is they abstract away the economy from humanity, and they kind of abstract away the fact that we are the economy, and kind of knowing that just makes appreciating everybody and everybody's roles so much easier, and it makes it all a lot more powerful.
Yeah, uber bullish and uber optimistic. And I think don't worry, be happy. It's a good thing to live by. And don't trust, verify. They go very well together.
Yeah. I mean, this was a terrific space to just send us into the weekend. I really appreciate it. Joe, did you have any closing thoughts, closing questions, anything like that?
I just love the optimism, and, you know, optimism that's backed up by facts, because I think it's easy to get pessimistic in this world where, you know, we see so much authoritarianism and so much propaganda. And we forget that, you know, we're living in a time when Bitcoin exists and Bitcoin was invented. And, you know, the world has never had a tool for human liberty and freedom like we have today. And when you just zoom out and see the education and you see the education taking place, you know, just like we can't comprehend what the world will look like on a hard money standard, like we can't comprehend, you know, all that's going to be fixed with this new opportunity that there's nothing to compare to in history. So Knut, I thank you for all that you do. You add so much value to the space. I've learned so much from you, and I know thousands of others have. And thank you for this space. This was awesome.
Thank you for having me. And you'll find most of my Bitcoin stuff here on Twitter. Yeah, and there's some merch at knutswanholm.com where you find all my books and stuff. Also, the wine is coming soon, and I'm doing Geyser Fund for the new book. It's called Praxeology, What They Never Taught You in School. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. Going to Madeira on the 7th of February. So if you're headed that way, maybe we can have a steak or something, or a poncha. So yeah, happy weekend to everyone. and keep Bitcoin, keep up, chin up.
I look forward to the day when we can have a steak together. Thanks everybody for listening in, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.
Bye.
And don't miss the Freedom Footprint Show. I'm doing a weekly show and a podcast now called the Freedom Footprint Show. So if you haven't seen that, follow at the Footprint Show on Twitter and you'll get notifications. I retweet every episode as well. So latest guest, I think next week, Prince Philip is coming up.
Wow. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah. So show about Bitcoin and philosophy.
And when is your book? Do you have a date on when your book's coming out?
I might as well do the shameless shill since I'm still here.
Yeah.
I'll be rehashing and re-releasing the first two books, Sovereignty Through Mathematics and Independence Reimagined, into one book. To be honest, they were more like pamphlets than books before. But so now it's a proper book. And Prince Philip will write the foreword for that. So that's coming sometime during this spring. And the praxeology book should be out like 2 months from now, maybe three. And that will be accompanied by a course on emeralize.com, which is sort of a Udemy meets Substack powered by the Lightning Network. So it will be, you know, a course for which you can buy lessons via the Lightning Network. So I'll bring those three books. Yeah, I'm being everything divided by 21 million. The whole bunch of conferences this year. I have planned, though not booked tickets yet, but I have planned for Stuttgart, Sydney, Miami, Prague, Riga, what else? Yeah, Bulgaria maybe. But there's a bunch of conferences coming up that I plan to attend.
Nice. That's amazing. And, you know, we're big fans of Mises and praxeology and Austrian economics here. And, you know, maybe we'd love to have you on another Spaces in the future after your book comes out. And I'd just like to thank you again. And I think we'll end the space here. But thanks again, Newt.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what do you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at Coinbits app. And be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast. We'll be right back.